I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Yuval Noah Harari, author of the international best-selling book about our species, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We are now halfway through the final month of the Jewish calendar, Elul, which means Rosh Hashanah is just 2 weeks away, the Jewish New Year. This is the time of year in Jewish tradition when we examine our lives in the past year, think about how we've lived, and decide how we can improve and change in the coming 5776 year. Change is always challenging, even when it's for the better. Generally speaking, it's always easier to do the same thing over again the same way. We already know how to do what we've already done, after all. And even if the results aren't fulfilling or meaningful, they are predictable. That's why so many of us find it nearly impossible to make significant changes in our personal lives or conduct. We somehow think that if we just keep doing what we've been doing, we will succeed this time. In response to that approach, the great Jewish physicist Albert Einstein defined insanity as doing the same thing over and over again, but expecting a different result. And yet, isn't that what most of us choose to do in our lives? As we move into the home stretch of this 5775 year on the Jewish calendar, the danger is that we'll continue to do what we've always done and arrive next year at Rosh Hashanah to discover that we've made the same mistakes and again failed to improve our lives. If that turns out to be the case, we will have wasted the opportunity to make our lives better, holier, more meaningful. We will have failed in our essential purpose in life. This very special time of year gives us a chance to choose to live better, more sacred, more valuable lives. All that we must do is look in the mirror honestly and see reflected there someone who has the capacity to become more than he or she was in the last 12 months. That someone is you. You are the one who has to act to make it happen. The first step during Elul is to apologize to anyone you've offended or hurt. In the whole year, try it today. Call somebody you should have called recently, or whom you ignored when they needed you. Find a person you wronged and try to make it up to them. Reach out. Do something caring for somebody who cannot benefit you. It's all part of the process we call tshuva, in Judaism, return or repentance. It's a great process, sometimes a challenging one, but it leads to real growth and return. And it is the best and sometimes only way to make your life better in this coming Jewish year. To play us in on this theme of tshuva, return, just 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah begins on Sunday, September 13th, here's a bit more of our pre-High Holy Day preview of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur music. It's from the Liturgy of Forgiveness and Pardon, Adon HaSlichot, Lord of Forgiveness, sung by Congregation B'nai Jeshurun in New York City.
Rachem aleinu, adon b'niflaot, matit
was Adon Haslichot, the Lord of Pardon, from the liturgy, in preparation for Rosh Hashanah. Compared to the other members of the animal kingdom, we human beings are slow, weak, and unprotected. So how did we manage to become the dominant species on the whole planet? And what can we learn about our own nature and how it can threaten the very existence of this world over time? Find out from our fascinating guest this morning, Israeli author Yuval Noah Harari, a professor whose book Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, has become an international sensation. We'll talk with him when we come back in a few moments, right here on Too Jewish.
Everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but were afraid to ask. Temple Emmanuel's famous Taste of Judaism program, now in its 16th year, offers an exploration of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on Jewish spirituality, values, and community, taught by our rabbis. Call 327-4501 for more information and to register today. Taste of Judaism is an exciting opportunity to learn about Jewish culture, history, rituals, and practice. The classes are free and open to all, and we feed you too. We have daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, and this year in Suarita as well. In partnership with the Tucson Hebrew Academy, the whole family can learn at the Taste of Judaism family class. And we're thrilled to offer American Sign Language Interpretation, ASL, for one of the sessions. Remember, there are no fees or obligations, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila at 327-4501 or email mila@templeemmanueltucson.org. That's Taste of Judaism, 520-327-4501, a fun way to learn about Judaism. Don't miss it.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through 8th grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Yuval Noah Harari has written an extraordinary book, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, which has, I think, taken the intellectual world more or less by storm. He was born in Haifa, Israel. He received his PhD from Oxford in 2002 and lectures in the Department of History at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, teaching some massive online open courses, as well as writing and receiving a variety of awards for creativity and originality. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning.
So, A Brief History of Humankind, the title taken a little bit from Stephen Hawking. Do you feel that you're doing the same kind of thing for humanity, biology, and history as he did for physics?
I try to build a bridge between the latest discoveries and theories of people in the humanities and the general public, the same way that Hawking did with physics, yes.
You know, one of the fascinating parts about this book is it's so conversational in tone, it's accessible. We think of biological writing sometimes as being accessible, but often very challenging. That flavor might lead people not to understand how deep the comments are that you make about our very nature. Did you choose that tone, or is it just the way you write?
No, I chose it deliberately because my ideal readers were basically my undergraduate students at the Hebrew University, and I wanted to write in a way which will not only be easily accessible, but also interesting and captivating to them.
There are many captivating concepts you bring up. One of them is that we human beings are able to control the planet. We become the most successful species on the planet because we believe in things that don't really exist or that exist only in our own imagination. Can you clarify that point a little bit?
We basically control the world because we are the only species that can cooperate in large numbers and do so flexibly. Whether it's reaching the moon or building the pyramids or splitting the atom, it's all the result of mass-scale cooperation. And we can cooperate in large numbers because we believe in stories, because of our imagination. If you examine any large-scale human cooperation, you always find at its basis some fiction. It can be fictional stories about gods, about nations, about money, about human rights. All these things, at least as far as science is concerned, are just fictions in people's minds. There are no gods, no nations, no human rights, and no money anywhere except in the stories that people invent and convince each other to believe.
You know, people tend to think that about religion. When you make that point about money, you touch a sensitive subject. You make the case that capitalism is the most successful religion in human history. Can you explain that?
Basically, the only religion that everybody believes and the only religion whose advocates, whose followers, are actually doing what the religion tells them to do. Like, you know, Christians, they are supposed to, if somebody insults you, you should turn the other cheek. So, but almost nobody does that. But with capitalism, the main commandment for the rich is to invest your money in making more money, and for the poor is to buy more and more, consume more and more. And if you do that, you'll get paradise here on earth. And it's the only religion whose followers are actually doing what they're supposed to do.
Fascinating. We will talk much more with the remarkable Yuval Noah Harari and his book Sapiens when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. We started talking last week about Freedom Smoke, the smokeless product, no tobacco, to get people off of cigarettes. What are the health advantages to using your product as opposed to smoking?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. We have a lot of physicians here in town, from neurologists to ophthalmologists, cardiologists, pulmonologists, sending patients to us because of damaging effects from emphysema, everything of the like that comes from smoking cancerous cigarettes.
And Freedom Smoke International provides all kinds of flavors, pleasurable experience, but not the same health risk.
That's right. You have the same experience as smoking. You have the hand-to-mouth, the mantra of the In-N-Out, as well as vapors compared to cigarette smoke. So there's no secondhand smoke either.
How can people find your product?
They can find us through freedomsmokeusa.com. Our toll-free number, which is here in Tucson, is 800-705-7013.
And then go into a store.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have 3 stores. We're opening a 4th in the next couple of months here in town.
We will talk more next week. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com, TOOJewishRadio18, or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, or download us from there, or at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We have 14 months to go until the election for President of these United States, but it's better to start early than late. We continue now our special election year or so feature, the 2016 Too Jewish Presidential Report. In-depth coverage, unusual features, and the finest opinion on the air as we choose the new leader for our nation. In a sign of the increasing influence of identity group politics on the Republican side of this election cycle, presidential candidate Jeb Bush is reportedly gathering a group of Jewish leaders to support his campaign. The Jeb Bush National Jewish Leadership Team will comprise leaders and prominent donors who have endorsed the former Florida governor. The team is being put together by Republican fundraiser Lisa Spies, who performed the same function for Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney back in 2012. However, Romney's efforts began only when he had already clinched the nomination. But Bush, Jeb that is, who trails Donald Trump in the polls, is starting much earlier, before the primary season has even officially begun. Several of Romney's 2012 backers have already endorsed other candidates this cycle, like Florida Senator Marco Rubio or South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham. We will stay tuned. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our Mivi Na on Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Well, the issue of the day, the issue of the summer, the issue for a long time has been the deal with Iran on nuclear development. And in many ways, the real issue is not whether this is going to become international law, because it will, but how the Jewish community has responded. Let's talk about what they think about it in Israel and what's happened here in America.
And just to remind all of us that the issue is not the voting or the agreement, is the shared goal that I think everyone will agree that the goal is to prevent Iran to have a nuclear weapon.
From becoming a nuclear power.
So it's not just this summer, it's for many, many years, an issue for many years. And there is a diverse voice among, not just among the Jewish people, of course, but there is diverse voices, and I want to focus on the Jewish communities, because some of the Jewish communities decided to take, you know, a side,
strong,
I would
stands,
say.
Strong stands, pick a side.
Yeah. And I can say that some of them paid a high price because the diversity
in
their
the
community,
opinion,
yes,
the community itself.
And we need to respect that. And some communities decided just to educate, which is more important, to educate the community and to provide a lot of opportunities to discuss, to read, to understand, to understand the agreement, although we know that it's not about the agreement, it's about the partners who signed the agreement and about the 5+1. Who are the stakeholder of this agreement?
Right, the stakeholders are the United States, and then the
five plus Iran.
UN Supreme Council plus
which
European
is
Union,
Russia, France, you know, Germany, France.
Russia, France, Germany, China,
and
right.
And it's
not
important
what Germany
to
added,
mention
right.
them,
right.
Because you need to know who agreed or who is the 5+1 and what their benefit out of this agreement. It's important to understand. It's not like that, you know, Chachmei Sanhedrin came with this agreement.
It's not like the Jewish Sanhedrin that's proposing this, and it's not, frankly, even the United States President and Congress. It's all of these other nations, United Kingdom, France, China, Germany is the additional one, the European Union, all Russia, all of these major powers have agreed to this with Iran.
And I know we talked about it like a few weeks ago,
right.
That there is a lot of, you know, a big money involved, like
huge.
Some of them like doing it from the wrong.
Yeah, some of them have a lot of business interests with Iran. They see great business.
Let's
potential
say
with
that
Iran.
Not this, the Israel security wasn't the first thing that they thought when they came up with this agreement. And it's important to educate the community so they will, when they will raise their voice, it will be from, you know, from the right reasons.
So let's talk briefly. It's going to become an international agreement, whether the United States Congress votes it down, whether or not the Congress overrides a veto by President Obama. It's going to be a fact. He can act without congressional approval on this. The Jewish community has divided clearly over it. And while I would say the majority support, if you will, the AIPAC position, completely opposing it, trying to, you know, it's the worst agreement ever, that needs to be stopped, Iran will immediately become a nuclear power. And a minority, but a significant and vocal minority, and sometimes a wealthy minority, supports what, for want of better terms, would be the J Street perspective, that, look, this is the best agreement we're going to get. It'll slow Iran's progress towards nuclear power, towards nuclear weaponry. Puts those of us who work in the Jewish community in a funny position, doesn't it?
The short answer is yes. The long answer is, I just want to add that Israel is strongly against it, of course. And I'm not saying
right.
only Bibi, I'm saying Israel,
no,
which
whole,
is, and we talked about
Israeli
it already.
Israeli public opinion is
yeah,
very strongly
it's against it. Yeah, it's very strongly against it. And also, again, I think we will finish with the fact that it's not the nitty-gritty details of the agreement. Is if you trust Iran,
or do you not trust Iran?
Like for the recent, just recently, they said that they will bring the sample to UN and not allow them.
Not the UN inspectors can't come in, right?
I think.
Yeah, it seems pretty clear. As Reagan said, trust but verify. Thanks so much, Ashrat. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, you just got back from Europe. I was there maybe a month or two before you. The attitude towards Israel in Europe and really all over the world is troubling for Jews, I think, and probably should be. Let's talk about that a little bit.
I think that's right. I think that starting back some point way back, like in the late 70s or early 80s, Israel stopped focusing its hasbara efforts, its sort of public
PR
relations efforts, right, on Europe and the world at large, and started focusing almost exclusively on the U.S. Congress, which, you know, may be cost-effective, but has cost Israel dearly in terms of its competition for public opinion and public affection against an increasingly effective and highly financed Arab propaganda machine in Israel. So most people in Europe, especially if they're remotely left-wing or even neutral, sort of center politically, tend to favor the Arab version of current events and of history and the Arab narrative. But I had a really interesting conversation with the 17-year-old son of a close friend who lives in Tampere, Finland. Finland doesn't have a huge Jewish community, never did.
Never had, you're right.
Not a particularly anti-Semitic country. And like most of the northern European countries, it used to send a lot of volunteers to kibbutzim and moshavim in the old days, in the 60s and 70s.
The sort of social democrats connected with the social labor movement
right.
in Israel.
It was the Socialist International, but right. all the people from like Denmark, Holland, Norway, Sweden, Finland went in droves. I mean, hundreds, if not thousands, over a period of a decade or so.
Even Germany, actually, for that matter.
Right. And they worked on kibbutzim, and they caused some problems. I mean, they occasionally were there, like, just to do drugs or sleep with local members of the opposite sex, and they occasionally broke up couples or caused domestic disturbances on the kibbutzim, whatever, because they were young and different and exotic, and they were only there temporarily, usually for 6 months, sometimes for a year, sometimes for 2 years, and sometimes they stayed. But the numbers dropped dramatically starting at some point in the late 70s or early 80s. And they dropped for two reasons. One is that the Northern Europeans lost interest and sympathy with Israel. And two is that the Israelis were less and less enthusiastic about these kids who didn't actually do so much work, but caused all kinds of legal or familial problems within the tight-knit community of the kibbutz or the moshav or whatever. So anyway, I'm having this discussion with a high school boy whose parents are very close friends of mine. The last time I saw their two kids, their kids were like 5 and 7 respectively. Now they're 15 and 17. So among other things, the 17-year-old is like 6'8". He towers over his father. He's like a tall string bean. And like most Finns, speaks absolutely perfect English without ever having set foot in an English-speaking country. And he showed a remarkably sophisticated understanding of politics in the Middle East. And I'd like to share with you and your listeners the gist of my discussion with him, but it looks like we may be running out of time, so perhaps next week.
We will talk next week and continue this. It's important stuff, and I don't think too well understood in the United States. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Jarrow Psych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is set. May 29th to June 9th, 2016. If you want to go with me on this fantastic journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to amazing Jerusalem, please email me at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's toojewishradio18@gmail. Or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Jake had worked hard all his life, but spent nothing. He saved everything he ever made. In fact, he was a miser about money. He loved it more than anything. Just before he died, he said to his wife, "Now listen, Leah, when I die, I want you to take all my money and put it in the coffin with me. Do this, because I'm going to take my money with me, all the way to the afterlife, to Gan Eden. Promise me." So Leah promised. Jake finally died. At his funeral, Leah was with her friend Rebecca. After they buried Jake, Rebecca said to Leah, "Hope you weren't stupid enough to put all that money in there with Jake." Leah replied, "Well, I promised him. I'm a good Jew. I can't lie. I promised I would put all that money in there with him." "You mean to tell me," said Rebecca, "you put every penny of his money in the coffin?" "I sure did," said Leah. "I wrote him out a check for the whole amount and put it in the casket." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now, a word of Torah. The great labor Zionist thinker Ahad Ha'am taught that Judaism is made up of three great elements: God, Torah, and Israel. So what are we to make of a central Jewish text that omits one of these three? This week we read the Torah portion of Ki Tavo in Deuteronomy. It begins with an unusual declaration. "When you come into the land that the Lord your God will give you as an inheritance, take the first fruits of your produce, bring them to the priest, and say, Arami Oved Avi, my father was a wandering Aramean. He came to Egypt, few in number, became a great nation there. The Egyptians dealt harshly with us and enslaved us, but God brought us out with a great hand and an outstretched arm and brought us to this place flowing with milk and honey." In addition to its central role in this important biblical ritual, the passage is quoted often in rabbinic literature, most famously in the Passover Haggadah. But this formula for what we're supposed to say when we bring our offering to the tabernacle or later the temple is surprising. In its mini history of our ancient people, it includes two of the greatest elements in their history, Yetziat Mitzrayim, the exodus from Egypt, and the entry into and settlement of Eretz Yisrael, the great homeland of Israel. Curiously, it omits all mention of a third equally crucial event, the giving of Torah at Mount Sinai. It's a fascinating, even a shocking omission. If the three most important elements of Jewish identity are God, Torah, and Israel, omitting Torah means having an incomplete version of Judaism. Ironically, here in the Torah itself, what is missing is, well, Torah. One explanation for this omission in Ki Tavo teaches us a lot about how religion evolves. and what an organic and remarkable creation Judaism really is. In biblical times, our people constituted an agricultural nation living on and with the land. The most important religious experiences were farming-related, planting crops, harvesting, dividing produce, offering it, eating it. The connection to the land itself and the labor needed to produce food from it was absolutely central to our identity. Eretz Yisrael was truly the holy land of Israel, and our intimate and permanent relationship to that land was forged over centuries of daily labor and life. When Zionism reconnected Jews to the land in the 19th century, in a real, tangible, practical way, it revived the whole experience of loving and serving God by creating food from the earth, Hamotzi Lechem Min Haaretz. The land of Israel was at the heart of our people then. It's also at the heart of Ki Tavo, as we hope it will be at the heart of every Jew in the world today. Like Eretz Yisrael, God too was central to Jewish life in the time of the Bible, as today. In Ki Tavo, we're commanded to bring this offering to God in the tabernacle and later the temple, to thank God for all that we have. We are supposed to remember the great gift of freedom that was conferred upon us by God, miraculously redeeming us from Egyptian slavery. Everything comes from God. A good lesson today, as in the days of Deuteronomy. So there's God and Israel here, but not Torah. Clearly, the third leg of this stool of Jewish identity was far less crucial to our ancestors than the other two. But why? As farmers in our own land, the need to study Torah in whatever form it existed must have seemed less than urgent. We had an immediate relationship with the earth, the land. We needed God for the basics that make agriculture possible: rain, sun, good soil. The importance of Torah was diminished when we lived on the land. When we were sent into exile, however, and forcibly torn from the land, we needed Torah. In fact, without the study of Torah, Judaism would have disappeared and the people of Israel faded into the dust of history. Torah alone preserved us, gave us the moral foundation, the religious identity, not only to survive, but thrive. When we read in Ki Tavo, in the Torah, of course, that we are to give a tenth of all we have earned to charity, to the poor, the homeless, the widow, and the orphan, we acknowledge that we have been blessed. We follow an ancient agricultural practice, perhaps more than 3,000 years old, designed for a people in a land of long ago. But we are also using this remarkable text, the Torah, to teach us how to live today. For wherever we are in the world, it is the Torah that binds us together and makes possible our unity as a people. It is the Torah that reminds us to worship God and of our connection to the Holy Land of Israel. It is the Torah that teaches us that tzedakah, charity, must be part and parcel of our very being. Paradoxically, even when the Torah seems to be absent, as here in Ki Tavo, this week's Torah portion, it is not only implicitly present, but secretly central in our religion and, we hope, in our lives. May it always be so. When we return in a moment here on Two Jewish, our guest, Israeli professor Yuval Noah Harari, author of the international bestseller Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, will explain just how strange our species really is and why we took control of the planet from other human species. Find out when we come back in a few moments on Two Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In power for more than a decade and facing a mounting challenge to his stewardship, 80-year-old Mahmoud Abbas resigned last week as chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization's Executive Committee, its top decision-making body. In most situations around the world, this would result in a changing of the guard, or at least a younger leader emerging. Not with the Palestinians. The move, in which nine of Abbas's colleagues on the 18-member committee also stepped down, is little more than a maneuver to bolster his own standing and weaken opponents. Under PLO rules, Abbas's step forces the 714-member Palestinian National Council or Parliament into session. Within 30 days, they must elect a new committee. That is when Abbas will be re-elected committee chairman and pack the committee with his cronies. If, as is widely expected, Israel bars legislators living in Gaza or exile from attending the September 15th meeting of the legislature in Ramallah, in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, Abbas loyalists will be the ones choosing the committee, and they will be sure to exclude potential rivals like Yasser Abed Rabo and Mohammed Dahlan, former top officials of the PLO who have been critical of Abbas. The Palestinian Authority is the secular leadership body of the Palestinian people, the relevant ruling power in the West Bank. It is the descendant of Yasser Arafat's original PLO organization and political movement, Fatah. Under the leadership of Mahmoud Abbas, known as Abu Mazen, the Palestinian Authority has long been accused of being corrupt, controlling, and out of touch with the Palestinian people. All of this is true. However, Israel and all civilized nations, and some not-so-civilized ones even, prefer dealing with the Palestinian Authority instead of trying to work with Hamas, its great rival, the lunatic Islamist group of terrorists dedicated to murder and an unending effort to destroy Israel and kill Jews. If you recall, Hamas defeated the Palestinian Authority in a brutal civil war in 2007. The ongoing war of words and occasional assassinations between Hamas and Fatah ended with a 2012 agreement to share power. That provoked a great deal of consternation in Israel and America, but of course the committee established between Fatah and Hamas has never actually met in the subsequent 3 years, and Abbas continues to be the power in the West Bank, essentially unopposed. Well, whatever awful things you wish to say about Hamas, all of it true, they were actually elected democratically. Abbas was elected to a 4-year term as president in 2005, but has not faced another vote since then. Democracy among the Palestinians does not exactly operate flawlessly. You can make that case everywhere in the Arab world, come to think of it. About this latest maneuver, Palestinian political analyst Hani Al-Masri says that Abbas was signaling he does not plan to step down anytime soon, even though he is 80 years old. He wants everything to be in his hands, Masri said. And Gaith Al-Omari, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, writes that the resignations were likely internal political maneuvers aimed at consolidating power. And there is no independent judiciary in the Palestinian Authority to appeal this to, because there is no independent judiciary in the Palestinian Authority even after 2 decades of operation. And the beat goes on. Without belaboring the point, Israel, by contrast, has a vibrant democracy, a free and critical press, and a totally independent judiciary with a highly respected and powerful Supreme Court. Just saying. In a follow-up story to the recent Nepal earthquake disaster, Nepal's Supreme Court has now issued an injunction to stop women from carrying surrogate pregnancies, depriving Israeli same-sex couples of the option to begin pregnancies in Nepal. The injunction issued last week came as the court prepares to rule on a petition to ban the process outright. The petition argues that surrogacy exploits the bodies of impoverished Nepalese women. The court must respond to the petition within 15 days. Israel bans surrogate pregnancies within Israel for same-sex couples, causing many to turn to surrogacy in foreign countries. Nepal has emerged as a relatively affordable option for that, especially since India and Thailand both have banned surrogacy. When Nepal suffered its major earthquake in April, several of the Israelis evacuated were couples who had been in the country picking up their surrogate children. The publicity into this little-known process has clearly marked it for elimination from the small, impoverished Asian nation. The ruling will not affect couples already in the midst of surrogate pregnancies, but it will bar couples from starting them.
The Center for Surrogacy Israel estimates that about 100 Israeli couples begin the process in Nepal each year. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Yuval Noah Harari. His book, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, is, well, you've probably heard this before, but really brilliant in a completely accessible way, a way of understanding the biology, the society, really how we are as human beings on this planet. He was born in Haifa, got his PhD from Oxford, lectures in the Department of History at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and publishes many articles. Your background is in military history, is it not?
Yes, in medieval military history, crusades and things like that.
So how does one go from medieval military history and secret operations in the time of, in the age of chivalry, to understanding the whole of humanity from a biological perspective? That's a leap.
Yeah, it's a big leap. Actually, the Hebrew University asked me to make this leap. When they told me to prepare and teach an introduction to history course to first-year students. And when I started doing it, I was really captivated and fascinated by the breadth of vision of doing something like that, especially because we are living in a period when humankind is about to make maybe the most important decisions in the history of life on Earth. We now, science gives us the ability to start changing the most fundamental laws of life on Earth. After 4 billion years, when life was run according to the principles of natural selection, we are now moving to an era of intelligent design. We are gaining the ability to start designing life according to our wishes. And even more so, after 4 billion years, when life was confined to the organic realm, we are starting to break out of the organic realm and start engineering non-organic life. So this is a really huge, a huge revolution. And the question is whether we can make the right decisions about what to do with all this immense power. And I think that having a better understanding of our past, of where we came from and what is our place in the world, in the ecological system, can help us make better and wiser decisions about all this immense power that we've now accumulated.
You make some really compelling arguments for the qualities of our species, including one that we have we have eradicated more major species in the course of our time on Earth than anybody could possibly have imagined. Why is that?
Well, we are not really sure why, but Homo sapiens is definitely an ecological serial killer, and it's not a new phenomenon. It's not something just in the last 200 years since the Industrial Revolution. Already before the Agricultural Revolution, before humans built the first village or planted the first wheat field, our ancestors already drove to extinction about half of the large mammals of the different continents. In Australia, the extinction was more than 90%. In America, when the first humans reached America about 15,000 years ago, they drove to extinction about 70% of the large animals of America. And maybe the reason is that we have that as a species, we are extremely good in acquiring power, but we don't really know what to do with it, and therefore we wreak havoc on the ecosystem and on the other animals, and we ourselves don't necessarily enjoy the benefits, because with all that power, we don't even know how to translate it into greater individual happiness for ourselves.
You make the ultimate case that we're probably no happier than our old Stone Age, our Paleolithic ancestors. How do we define that? How do you even categorize that?
Well, there are several ways of categorizing it. You can measure all kinds of things, like lifespan and child mortality and so forth. And you see that until about the middle of the 19th century, there is no improvement in these measurements for the vast majority of humankind. Over the last 150 years, for the first time, we see real improvement in some measurements, again, like child mortality, which dropped dramatically over the last century and a half. But on other fronts, you see that things are actually getting worse, not only in terms of the ecology, but also, for example, you see the crumbling of intimate communities and families after hundreds of thousands of years in which humans lived as part of small intimate communities and families. And this was the basis for daily life and also for human satisfaction. Over the same period of the last century or two, you see the crumbling of these age-old institutions. And today, people, at least in advanced societies, are much more lonely and alienated than they ever were before in history.
It's a depressing thought. And our electronic communication and our movement towards a wired world, does that have an impact on the development of human society in the future?
Certainly, it changes things to such an extent that today nobody really has a clue how human society would look like in 40 or 50 years, which is still within the lifespan of maybe most people
right.
who are listening to this program. It's really unprecedented. Like in the Middle Ages, there are many things you didn't know about the future, but the basic facts about how human society looks like, this didn't change in say, 50 years or 100 years. But now, when you think about the world in 2050 or 2060, nobody knows how the job market would look like. It's estimated that within 20 to 30 years, computers are going to take about half the jobs in the USA from humans, and it's unclear whether there'll be new jobs to replace them. Similarly, if you think about, again, families, nobody really knows what family structure would look like in 50 years. I mean, the most basic things, like relations between parents and children, or even if there will be, how many children will there be, these are now unknown. So it's a very, very volatile situation.
Maybe the most volatile in history. I want to take a step way back to the domestication, the first domestication of plants and animals, and the first cooperative work. This notion of the Neolithic Revolution is some kind of great jump forward in which human beings domesticated wheat and animals and became civilized. Is that an accurate understanding of what took place?
Depends on your perspective. From the perspective of the human collective, then yes, the agricultural revolution was a great leap forward, because without agriculture, you couldn't have cities and kingdoms and empires and so forth. But if you switch your perspective and look at things from the viewpoint of the individual human, things look quite different, because the life of the individual human actually became worse after the agricultural revolution. The life of a simple peasant in ancient Egypt was in many respects harder than the life of hunter-gatherers 20 or 30,000 years previously. First of all, in terms of work, peasants had to work much harder, and their jobs were more difficult and more boring. Our bodies and minds evolved for hundreds of thousands of years in adaptation to living as hunter-gatherers, go to the wood and look for mushrooms and climb trees and run after rabbits and things like that. And suddenly as peasants, what you did all day was go to the field and dig canals and bring water from the river and harvest and things like that. It's much more difficult to the body and more boring to the mind. In exchange, peasants got a worse diet. Hunter-gatherers subsisted by eating dozens, hundreds of different species of plants and animals and mushrooms and nuts and whatever. Peasants, in contrast, ate usually just one or two crops were the main suppliers of their diet, like if you lived in China. So you ate rice for breakfast and rice for lunch and rice for dinner, and that was it. And on top of all that, peasants suffered far more from infectious diseases, most of which came from domesticated animals, and they suffered far more from social hierarchies and exploitation, which was virtually much more limited in the times of the small hunter-gatherer bands. So from all these perspectives, the life of the individual actually got worse, while the human collective became far more powerful than before.
There's an extraordinary section in your book in which you deal with the question of death. Do other animals besides Homo sapiens have this same challenge? What happens after I die?
The simple answer is that we don't know. I mean, we have very circumstantial evidence, for instance, that elephants mourn the death of related elephants, and they even have some kind of cemeteries. But this, we don't really know what goes through the mind of an elephant. So it's impossible to say. What is interesting is about humans is that not all of them have the same level of interest in the question, what happens after I die? In the modern secular world, modern ideologies basically stopped talking about this issue. After thousands of years, when you have major religions arguing mainly about this question of what happens to you after you die, in the last two or three centuries, nobody speaks about it. I mean, communism, socialism, fascism, liberalism, feminism, they don't care at all. What happens after you die? It's an irrelevant question. Now, interestingly enough, I think it's the same with the Bible, or at least the earlier books of the Bible, like in Genesis or in most of the Torah, there is nothing about
what happens
to a person after he dies.
Right.
In Christianity, it's very central. In Islam, it's very central. But in Biblical Judaism, this question of what happens to you after you die, it's of no interest.
It's fascinating. And then even in Judaism today, throughout its history, there's some interest, but it's never central. I want to ask a last Jewish question, since the show is called Too Jewish. The story that we Jews tell is that the Torah, the process of studying and learning, is the central effort in human life, that if we can learn, then we can grow and we can be good. Is this a uniquely Jewish story to tell?
The idea that by acquiring wisdom and knowledge, you can improve yourself and you can improve society and the world, you find it in many other human cultures. It's certainly not unique to Judaism. Whether it really works like that or no, it's questionable. I mean, some kinds of knowledge certainly improve your life and improve the world, and humankind has some very significant achievements. But at the same time, there are many types of knowledge which it's questionable to what degree they actually improved humanity and the world. As I said earlier, humans are extremely capable, extremely good in acquiring more power, but they are not so good in translating that power into greater happiness. So knowledge that leads only to more power without knowing what to do with that power, this, I think, it's a very problematic approach. Unfortunately, it has characterized humankind for thousands of years.
Well, if you want to learn more about the world and your existence in it, I can highly recommend Yuval Noah Harari's book, Sapiens. I don't know if it will make you happier, but I'm sure it will make you wiser. Thanks so much for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Where can people go to find out more about you? What's your website?
The website is ynharari.com. It's ynharari.com.
Thanks so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9. Our guest will be Justice Richard Bernstein, a blind judge on the Michigan Supreme Court, who has completed 18 marathons and a triathlon.
an extraordinary and inspirational guy. Our playout this morning comes from the Maccabees, their parody of One Republic, and their Rosh Hashanah song, The Book of Good Life. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of peace.